Hello and welcome to another episode of This Week in Wealth. And what an episode we have for you. I'm Alex Steger, and today I'm joined not only by Ian Wenick, but by Andrew Forsch and Sam Bojarski. It's very much the, you know, everything on the menu. We've ordered all of it for you. And just to make things even more exciting, Sam is here in New York City. Andrew is calling in from Washington, D.C., and Ian is in Las Vegas, where he's roused himself from a potentially life-threatening injury to join us on the pod. Is that fair, Ian? Have I over-egged the pudding a little bit there?
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, this is basically the CityWire RA equivalent of the Michael Jordan flu game or Philip Rivers playing in the AFC Championship game on a torn ACL. I am here up after having injured my back somehow, some way. Weren't sure if I was going to be able to do it, but I'm here and I'm very excited to be on the pod today as usual.
Yeah. And within minutes, you've compared yourself to Michael Jordan. So this is good. You know, clearly your self-esteem has not been damaged by the injury. Very quickly, I'm sure listeners will want to know, and I don't think it's too personal a thing to ask Ian. How exactly did you injure your back?
I mean, that's a good question. So I'm a runner, and I injured my back in a similar fashion while running last year. I think that the culprit this time may have been a rogue chair at the pool deck at the Aria Resort and Casino. So that's what I'm blaming it on for the time being.
Okay. You told me earlier it was to do with getting into out of a low riding sports car. But if that part of the injury is not fit for podcast, we can cut it out. Anyway, look, that's quite enough on Ian's health. We're here. We've got a lot to get through, actually. So let's get into it. Now, the first story, Sam, this is a story you wrote this week we want to talk about, which is about Mercer, the big, what are we calling it these days? No one wants to be called an aggregator anymore, do they? They want to be called an enterprise RIA, consolidator, call it what you will. They'll have an opinion. Anyway, they have sued an Atlanta-based RIA, but it's an interesting lawsuit. So they haven't, it's not related to them trying to buy this particular firm or any sort of deal they've done with this particular firm. This firm, the firm in question, had the tenacity, audacity to hire an advisor, basically. But there's much more to it than that. So we're going to talk about that specific court case or potential legal filing first. And then we're going to zoom out to look at the context of that particular case, as well as perhaps sort of Mercer and its deal making more broadly. But before we get into all that, let's start at the beginning. Sam, I slightly butchered the intro to that story. So tell us, what's the story?
Yes, this is all part of some ongoing litigation that Mercer has with some former advisors. But the most recent story is they've sued this Atlanta area firm called Blue Chip Wealth Advisors that manages about $630 million in assets now. A little while ago, they hired an advisor by the name of Kevin Rainwater, who was formerly with Mercer, and Mercer formally sued Rainwater for alleged theft of trade secrets and violating restrictive covenants, and they're now suing Blue Chip for essentially facilitating that action.
Okay, so yeah, so and the interesting thing is here. So Rainwater was. Should we call him Kevin? Rainwater's a great surname. We should just say that quickly. He was part of a firm called ACG Wealth, right? And this is where this is the genus of the beef.
Yeah. Yeah. He was formerly part of ACG. There was a failed acquisition. Mercer acquired ACG back in 2021. That deal fell apart. Rainwater and several other advisors have since left Mercer after the acquisition, and there's been multiple lawsuits filed against those advisors.
Okay, so Andrew, you can swing in here because I think you wrote some of those previous stories as well. So maybe give us the rundown on what happened with ACG and Mercer and how we've kind of gone from an acquisition to can we use myriad? Maybe we can. Myriad lawsuits.
I think myriad is fine. Yeah, we've got dueling lawsuits on both sides, bunch of filings. These cases have now been kind of going on for I think we can say years now. What was this, November 2023 when we had the first story? So yeah, it's kind of a long-running legal battle. Basically, Mercer struck first, suing ACG Wealth and suing the co-founders for allegedly violating the terms of their sale by, again, allegedly selling Mercer revenue that was not theirs to sell. So some of the revenue, apparently, this is what Mercer is saying, some of the revenue that the principals of ACG reported owning actually belonged to advisors who were working under Form 1099 independent contractor agreements. And so that revenue would belong to those advisors and therefore would potentially follow those advisors if they were to leave Mercer. So that's the initial lawsuit. Pretty quickly there, ACG and its principals countersued Mercer, basically saying that after the acquisition happened, they prevented some top performing advisors from transitioning certain clients over, basically in order to prevent ACG from hitting a revenue threshold that would have entitled everybody to an additional earnout payment. And so there were these dueling suits that went on for quite some time, and now I think just about everybody's been sued, and there's hundreds of court filings, and here we are today.
Principals who obviously were sued and then countersued are no longer with ACG and thus part of Mercer. We know that Mr. Rainwater obviously isn't as well, and there's other advisors also who since left what was ACG too. Is that right, Sam?
Yeah. So the principals, Jeffrey Shaver and Jody Young, have long since left. There were a couple other advisors who left as well. I believe also in 2023, Ryan Malik and David Weitz, who Mercer has also sued, along with the RIA they formed called Unified Investment Management, which I believe is also based in Atlanta.
Okay. So in a way, this sort of new thing where they're suing a firm that an RIA joined, I suppose it's sort of new, but it's not wildly different from suing the RIA that people might have set up. Effectively, it's suing what they would view as the beneficiary of whatever these people did, and I suppose basically them taking their clients to that place.
Yeah, and discouraging other firms out there from hiring these folks.
Okay, so Ian, can you come in here and tell us a little bit about what this what this means in terms of where Mercer's at in its sort of in its project, or indeed what it sort of speaks to about big PE-backed firms and sort of how they have to go about their business?
So I'm glad that you asked that, because I think that this is kind of a you reap what you sow situation. So this ACG Wealth deal, I think it's worth noting that was a transaction that took place in 2021, which was really in the post-COVID era when a lot of the valuations and the deal structures were going crazy. So I actually spoke to Dave Barton, who was Mercer's head of M&A and at the time, in January of 21, a few months before the ACG deal happened. And what he explained to me was that they were structuring deals with a very short earnout period. In other words, how the distributions go out to the founders and principals of the selling company. He said typically 2 years, but in some cases, they were going shorter, to as short as 1 year. And he also said that a lot of the deals were trending towards 100% cash. And so we talk about what are kind of the fundamental factors driving M&A in this space. Well, a lot of it comes from succession planning and the fact that these firms have gotten so valuable that the second generation can't afford to buy the first generation out. So it doesn't shock me that there are firms out there where the founder may or may not have thought, okay, I can just sell to these guys for all cash, short earnout. There's nothing keeping me here. We get all the money. And then after a year passes, we can just bounce and do whatever we want to. So it doesn't shock me that there were firms that, in an acquirer's mind, might have exploited the M&A dynamics at the time. And I think it's not a shock that we've seen transactions or lawsuits happen where we see people suing advisors that are moving, because I think that a lot of these wealth managers, especially Mercer, they've gone through multiple rounds of private equity investment, all the valuation that we're seeing, they're contingent on keeping the clients and the advisors on the platform. If you don't have mechanisms to do that and keep advisors in place for longer and to keep the founders in place for longer, then you're going to see more lawsuits like this happen.
Okay. So yeah, no, I want to come back on that point on sort of obviously PE and what it's trying to protect. I suppose we should add a caveat here, which is like, we don't know the exact terms of this specific deal. Obviously what you were talking about with Dave Barton might pertain to this, but we can't say that for certain. And I suppose we should also say we shouldn't, you know, this is me with my my editor's legal hat on. We shouldn't necessarily cast aspersions on these particular principles in this instance. We don't know, you know, why they then chose to leave and you know, what the triggers might have been. So I think what you said is fascinating, but should be understood as a broader point and not necessarily specifically about this case. With that said, obviously, I think the point you make is a really good one, right? Which is, this was sort of a period of deal mania. And like you say, obviously, I think if you talk to anyone involved in the M&A space, it's all about aligning incentives and deals like such as the one you described maybe didn't align incentives, because obviously you've got people who can leave very quickly. There's not much keeping them there. And as we know, if you go, you can start up again at a certain point, and then that obviously kind of devalues the deal. If indeed that was the case for some of Mercer's deals, is that a little short-sighted of them, would you have said? Or was that just sort of what everyone was doing at the time? Is that just what you had to do in that period to get things done?
Yeah, I mean, there was so much happening. Look, we're setting records every year, but 2021 was a record year. We had a lot of people flush with cash in a low interest rate environment. So yeah, people could easily be competitive on price. They had to compete on terms. So it doesn't shock me that there were a lot of seller-friendly deals happening. And to this broader point, I mean, you know, I'm thinking back to what we talked about with the Hightower situation, how Hightower, the main issue was that the advisors became elevator assets. There was nothing keeping them there on the platform after the equity vested. This is kind of similar. If you don't have stuff like non-solicits, non-competes, even non-accept clauses in your contracts, and again, the validity of those has been challenged and a lot of even questioned by the FTC during the Biden administration, if you don't have protections for yourself, then you run the risk of deals going sideways like this.
That's very interesting. I suppose a couple of follow-ups there. Then, first of all, has this changed now then? Obviously, you said deal volume continues to, you know, go up and up each year. But are the terms less seller-friendly today than they were 4 years ago?
Anecdotally, so I don't want to, like we discussed, I don't want to go too far over my proverbial skis, but yeah, you know, I have heard anecdotally from some of my M&A sources that, yeah, you are working in longer earnout periods. Or the other incentive, which is the carrot as opposed to the stick, is you have more equity as a component. So you give the first generation, second generation advisors more skin in the game and incentive to stick around for the long term.
Got it. Okay. And then lastly, you sort of touched on this point a couple of times, which is obviously sort of PE protecting its, you know, what it's getting here. So acquiring these firms and obviously, you know, it's really acquiring assets and you don't want to see them walk out of the door. Are there other firms in similar positions to Mercer who are sort of also, I suppose, going after people where these have walked? Or is it a unique situation that they're sort of, you know, litigating some of these situations, or is it relatively widespread?
Yeah, I mean, we've seen litigation before. I mean, Mariner Wealth Advisors has gotten involved in litigation with Savvy. We've seen this with LPL and Ameriprise. That's more of a recruiting perspective. There is a relatively similar-ish lawsuit between a group that sold to Mercer and Mercer, which is in Florida. I believe it's in Florida state court, where the ex-advisors who sold to Mercer alleged that Mercer conspired with Charles Schwab to kick them off their custodial platform for their new practice as retaliation for leaving Mercer. That's a very short, condensed version of that story. So we've seen it go the other way.
Yeah, I think we've got enough lawsuits already in this story without bringing in a new one. That's my fault, so sorry. Okay, but I suppose coming back to the original story here that Sam wrote, what is interesting here is, you know, previously when people go after people in the sort of post-deal world, it's normally principals or advisors at the firm who they've acquired. But in this instance, what is somewhat different is they're going after the RIA that's then hired that advisor, and that's something that we haven't seen a lot of before. I guess, look, obviously, watch this space. I think we've covered that in a lot of detail, arguably too much. So we're gonna shift gears here, and we're going to come back to our pay report, which Andrew spoke about last week, and hopefully a lot of you have now read. And one bit of research which we didn't include in the original report was some less specifically on pay and more around sort of the hours that RAA and RAA employees work, and also sort of where they're working, whether from home, somewhat flexibly, or indeed all in the office. And I think there were some interesting results here, Andrew.
Yeah, I thought so too. And, you know, we ran the pay report, and we were kind of having a look at the data sheet that we had put together, and we had the data, and so we figured, why not use it? This is something advisors are interested in. It affects their lives, their home lives, their days, right? And so we basically, as part of the pay report, we had polled advisors on how many days a week they are working in the office versus at home. And then we separated that data out by job title, by firm type, and by years of experience. And there were a few kind of defining trend lines. I think the most important of which was probably years of experience. So just quickly, the basic numbers are these. We had 106 RIA respondents, employees of RIAs and other wealth management firms. About half of them are working in the office full-time all 5 days a week.
I'll be honest, that surprised me. I thought it would still be less, maybe because I'm, part of this soft media, I was going to say elite, but there's nothing elite about about my life. Maybe we're all sort of, East Coast softies, but I still don't. I mean, I know a lot of people in finance are working 5 days a week in the office, but I was surprised that RAAs, which are, spread out across the country, they aren't big financial institutions like, your JPMs and your BlackRocks, where they sort of big banks and big mandates. So I think, if I'm honest, I was a little surprised that it was as high as that.
Yeah, and even among firm types, RIAs, as compared to broker-dealers or OSJs, there were on average, employees of RIAs on average were working in the office about 3.5 days a week. So there is some flexibility built in. Maybe you get your Friday from home or whatever. But there has been a broad return. I mean, we've reported on many firms, kind of mandating employees back to the office. Not a lot of RIAs or kind of like new wealth managers are mandating full 5 days. We've seen that a lot more on Wall Street. But it does appear, there is a meaningful contingent of folks who are back in the office full time.
The other thing that surprised me, but perhaps shouldn't have done really, if one thinks about it, but was, I think you were about to start talking about this, the experience and how that affected how often you were in the office. So I think the general, or at one point in this kind of weird 5 year post-pandemic period, I felt there was a point at which there was a general sort of perception that younger people were very keen on flexible work and remote work. And it was older people who were like, no, you work in the office. That's what you've done. Get back to the office. But actually, the results of our survey would suggest that in terms of actual time now spent in the office, it's slightly flipped on its head.
Yeah, that's exactly right. There's a very pronounced trend there where the fewer years of experience an RIA employee had, at least per respondents to our survey, the more days you were spending in the office. And that was true in basically equal increments for every kind of 5 year bucket of experience up until you get to people who've been in the business for 25 years or longer, who are, as you say, back in the office more than anybody else. And I think that's just sort of the older school mentality. The vets of the business have returned to the office and maybe prefer that. They feel more productive there. And they just kind of think that that's the way business should be done. But it does appear that beyond that point, before that point, rather, people with more experience have kind of earned more flexibility. Maybe they have the trust of their teams to produce from their home or from wherever it is that they choose to work, whereas younger employees maybe need a little bit more oversight, maybe benefit from kind of the in-person team building sort of vibe.
More training and that kind and of
also,
thing as well.
And also, yeah, exactly that. Maybe need more training, which is more usually done and probably better done in person.
Yeah, I think Jamie Dimon, who CEO of JP Morgan, who has had some pretty choice quotes on this whole the whole issue of returning to the office, but I think quite recently said that his take was you just can't learn from your basement. Like you've got to be in the office to learn the ropes of the job. So that might again sort of speak to why those younger people are in more. Fantastic. Well, look, that's item two, and item three is Las Vegas. So Ian, other than injuring yourself in beach lounger, sports car related activities, which makes you sound, if I'm honest, a bit more rock and roll than you are. I hope you don't take offense at that. What are you doing there?
Well, I was obviously doing some deep research in advance of our RA Austin conference, where we'll be hosting professional poker player Bart Hansen by doing some market research at the Aria. But in all seriousness, I was here for the Ozaic NXT conference, which is a conference that Ozaic puts on for their younger financial advisors. There are about 500 advisor attendees. And I was moderating a panel on succession planning, which conveniently enough fits into a lot of what we've been talking about today.
So NXT, I'm guessing, is like Next, but they used up all the vowels in the name of their firm, so they didn't have any left for the conference. Okay, so it was younger advisors. You were chairing a panel on succession planning. I suppose we've covered a certain amount of that, but interested to hear sort of your sense of the sort of the vibe of the event, who was there, maybe what it spoke to about either kind of the state of Ozaic today or more perhaps more broadly kind of the industry and where younger advisors fit.
So what I was very excited about with this panel, which is that when I'm moderating stuff, a lot of time I feel like it's with CEOs, like quote-unquote heavy hitter names. But the people that I got to talk to were one gentleman who runs a practice in Missouri, I believe central Missouri, another woman who is an advisor, she's about my age, for an Ozaic-affiliated practice on Long Island. And so we were kind of talking about how the gentleman advisor, his name's Sean Manuel, he was talking about how he found his eventual successor and how he discussed this with his wife and what the plans for turning over the business. And for the female advisor named Nicole Wood, she explained a lot about how she's been kind of brought into this family business, how she's going to eventually split ownership of the practice with the founder's son. And so we got to talk about what the mechanics were like about that. And I thought it was really fun that I got the chance to talk about this stuff with people that are doing it on the ground in real time, as opposed to talking about the theory of it. And on top of that, there were several top Ozaic officials there. I had the pleasure of interviewing Jamie Price, who is the CEO, and we'll have that interview published shortly. I also got to talk to Greg Cornick, who is one of the top officials there as well.
Very quickly, because we've packed a lot in, and I mean, we're not over time in that we can decide how long this is, but we're running a little longer than usual. This section of the pod, we might just have the diehard fans left. But give us a sort of 30 seconds, 1 minute on what you talked about with Jamie Price, Ozaic CEO.
Yeah, so we talked about a couple of different things. What I was most excited to discuss with him was, one, and Eva Thomas, our intrepid professional buyer reporter, she talked to Jamie back in February, so this is kind of following up on that. We talked about what an eventual monetization event for Ozaic would look like, and we talked about the timeline for their relationship with their current private equity sponsor, Reverence Capital Partners, which has controlled them since 2019. We talked a little bit about everybody's favorite topic, the LPL Commonwealth transaction, and we also talked about Ozaic's decision to not have its own in-house custody business. They're one of Pershing's biggest customers. They also work a lot with Fidelity's National Financial Services. So we talked about the decision to not go self-clearing. So a couple of different themes we covered, and very excited to get that interview out. It was a very fun conversation.
Excellent. Sam, Ian, jealous to not be in Vegas? What did you do last time you were there?
I played a lot of poker last time I was there, with Ian, actually, as a matter of fact.
Who came out better for that?
We did, actually, by pure luck. We had the cheapest rental car possible. We got a Dodge Charger, despite paying like $50 for the rental, and we spent the whole day out in Death Valley, which was really fun.
It was a fantastic day. No comment on my poker games, though.
Good day, less good night. Andrew, have you been there recently?
Not lately. It was a lot easier to get out there when I was living in Los Angeles. So no, I'm going to have to find some kind of wealth management adjacent conference to justify a visit back out there soon.
Yeah, I think Ian has some good tips on how to do that. Excellent. Well, look, we'll leave it there. Ian, thank you for, dosing up on meds and joining us through the pain. Ian and Sam, an absolute pleasure. Thank you both for joining us. And of course, listener, thank you very much. And we will be back again soon for another episode of This Week in Wealth.